I've been working on this episode for 5 months, and I was hoping to have released it 3 days ago, and then yesterday, and I realized today that it's never going to be perfect. I've edited and re-edited it from scratch, like 6 or 7 times. I've listened to these stories probably 20 times apiece. And I still don't know the best way to tell this story as a whole. Of all the stories I've told on this show, this one is the most important to me. And I really need to get it right. I need to do it justice. I need to honor everyone involved. More than just a place and a story, Austin, Indiana is a moment in time. It's a microcosm for the State of the Union right now. It's a moment where we can either all come together to listen, to care, to do what's right, to look beyond the scope of our own beliefs, or it's one through piety, self-righteousness, and ambition, we can further broaden the divide between us. It's a place and time where politics, religion, public health, addiction, the media machine, and humanity have all coalesced, with seemingly only 2 possible results: unity or division. This is a story in 3 parts, and this is the first.
God, I pray tonight that you will heal Austin, God. That, God, you will heal Scott County. In Jesus' name, heal our land, God.
Austin is a small rural town in southern Indiana with about a population of 4,000. And it's in some ways, a very tight-knit community, depending on what side of the spectrum your family comes from, in a sense. That divide is noticeable to a degree, but at the same time, even though there's that divide, everybody knows everybody, if that makes any sense at all. For me, there's a few like prominent families that own a majority of the businesses in town, or a majority of the subdivisions or the rental properties, you know. And then, you know, you have the other people that, if they're not kind of born into that family or those families, they're kind of just there. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but the way Austin is and its location is, it's hard to just go find a job at a factory, because even the close factories can be several miles away and those people would have to walk. I guess what I'm saying is the people like on the north side where the drugs and stuff are affected, they don't have a steady income, or they don't have a form of transportation, and they have no way to get to those jobs. Whereas the other side of that spectrum have created their own businesses or have car lots or have rental properties and have been in the town for years and years and years and have been fortunate enough to make a name for themselves and make money for themselves, if that makes any sense. And I don't like to call it a divide because it's not like it's purposefully done. It's just, that's just how southern Indiana is. You have people who are fortunate and you have the people who just have not been that fortunate to have the necessities in life to continue their life in a better way. Austin is there's still not a black family that lives in Austin. Every once in a while, you might see some Latinos or, you know, Mexicans that come in and they do work. For example, my grandfather does hire some of the Mexicans that live in the area for different types of work. I don't mean that to sound bad or anything like that, but they're really good at the type of work that they do, and they get hired quite a bit by quite a bit of people in the town. But there, as far as I know, I take that back. There is one black family in town that I know of. Yeah, Austin back in the day was a pretty racist area. If you were not white, you didn't go into the town. You had to be out of town by nightfall, or you wouldn't live. That's the history of Austin back in the 40s, 50s, 60s.
This is Seth Harold, a photographer who was born and raised in Austin. He lives in Western Ohio now, but has been frequently returning to his hometown to cover the drug epidemic he grew up around. An epidemic that's led to an HIV crisis in the small rural town. A crisis that has made Austin the epicenter of a tug of war between media, the government, public health, and even religion.
See, I got into documenting the drug issues there shortly after kind of if the HIV news broke out into like mainstream news and such. From my understanding, it has started really heavily with Opana, which is an opiate prescription painkiller, which a lot of the people that I've spoken to that have used it had back problems or surgeries in the past, and that's what has been prescribed to them now. And then, you know, it makes them feel better. It takes the pain away for a certain amount of time. And then slowly, you know, it just kind of, the pill just kind of spread because it was, in a way, just too easy to get for some people. And there was, you know, money to be made off of it. And from there, people were decided to break it down. Originally, they were snorting it, and the pharmaceuticals decided to put on a coating that would prevent them from being able to break it down to snort it. Someone figured out that they could melt that into a liquid and started shooting it up. So then that's where you get the HIV spreading from the sharing of the needles. But that's still the main drug is Opana. I know when I was there 2015 at some point, meth and heroin was starting to kind of get into that mix of drug usage, but the heroin wasn't, it was more just like chlorine filled. Some of it even like baking soda mixed into it. So it was very, I don't know if you could even call it heroin, but it was getting into that mix as well, from here and there. But Opana still is predominantly, from what I know, still the drug of choice for most people in that area.
The statistics paint a picture of how heavy that drug use has become. I was reading that about 5% of the town is HIV positive. And when you compare that to 12% in Zimbabwe, that's a really high rate of HIV.
Yeah, I mean, the town has a population of 4,000. And, you know, I think the final count for HIV positive individuals was like 245 or 250. Maybe, I don't think it has went up since then. But yeah, I mean, that's really a big number for such a small town and a small community like that. It's mind blowing that that's my town that I grew up in. You know, I had always planned to go back and do a story on my hometown. Not like that though. Not like that at all. When I was there working and stuff, walking around taking pictures and talking to people, you know, people would be like, "Oh, you know, what's your name?" And I would tell them, and then, like, you know, a gentleman was like, "Oh, I played basketball with your dad in high school." So, like, a lot of these people, like, I knew personally in a way. Not personally in a sense that I would sit down and, like, have lunch with them, but family history. You know, it really kind of hit home. Like, that could have been my dad, or that could have been me or someone else in my family that lives in the area. Thankfully, it's not, but it was just that it hit home.
At what point did it become clear to the community that there was a real problem?
I think, because I got there right, I think, shortly after the needle exchange program was, like, implemented. But I believe the community, off the bat, from what I understood, talking to different ones, they realized it was a real problem, and they were actually frustrated at the fact that Mike Pence wasn't allowing the needle exchange program to come in, even though some members of the community had questions about it after they had met with, like, the CDC, and different workers at the CDC had told them the positives of the needle exchange program. They accepted it a lot faster than what they would have. So I know that they knew it was a problem off the bat, and that frustration showed over time. I really kind of, in my own opinion, credit some of the coverage from the media of making Mike Pence get the needle exchange program in there, because there for a couple of weeks, I mean, it was like every day, you know, the number was rising, like, you know, 100 people HIV positive, 150 people HIV positive. I mean, he really didn't have a choice. And I think if it really wasn't for the media kind of getting in there and, like, talking and showing what was going on, that wouldn't have happened as fast, just from how Mike Pence kind of tended to view the situation.
What do you think was behind his resistance?
I think maybe his own personal religious views and conservative ways of thinking, which, you know, that's his beliefs and how he feels, and that's fine. But at some point, I feel like, especially in situations like that, you have to put your own convictions aside and realize, like, you have to help the people in your state that you are responsible for. And then I think, like I said, with the media coming out and saying, showing, hey, these numbers are rising daily, if he wouldn't have done anything to offset that, I think there would have been a very loud, like, speaking out of the different individuals in that town. I know, like, a lot of the high schoolers, even Holly Reynolds, which you probably may have heard if you've done some of the research, her and some of her classmates had meetings with the governor and the different health officials for the state of Indiana, like, telling them, like, hey, like, this is what's going on, we need to do this, this, and this. And I know different other people in the community were going up and having meetings as well. So I think a mix of media and different people from the community going and speaking to the right officials kind of just opened his eyes, like, yeah, we have a problem, and we just can't arrest these people or just go knocking down doors because they do have HIV. So it's let them continue to do this drug and slowly kill themselves, or take care of the problem and stop the spread. So I think those mixtures help that decision.
Well, and I think you kind of hit the nail right on the head for how a lot of marginalized and people on the periphery feel about politics in general, but specifically politics currently, which is, as a politician, you have to lead outside yourself, because you can't just represent your own personal feelings anymore. And I think that maybe Indiana is a very good example of why that doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, because if he would have stuck with those views, I mean, it's hard telling how many people would have ended up HIV positive, you know, or even the hepatitis C and stuff that has followed some of that. A lot of those people also have hep C. So it's like, how far would it have gone if he wouldn't have stepped outside of himself and his convictions?
Here is a truth about me. I am devoutly liberal and rabidly democratic. But when it comes to politics, I'm working on being less dogmatic and more understanding. It's difficult to do because these things aren't mutually exclusive.
Austin is, my grandpa called it, the asshole of America.
That's honest.
Yeah. It's a very small town. There's not a lot of employment, and what employment is there is, you know, it's hard to, of course, you know, nobody likes felonies and all that stuff. So if you're trying to go through a second chance or anything like that, then it's definitely hard to find jobs there. I mean, in, I guess, growing up there and going through high school, you heard very little talk about college or any kind of setting yourself up for a life other than working in a factory. Whereas where I live in Indianapolis now, you see a lot of people that are, you know, dressed up every day and going to work, and business type people, people on their own businesses. In Austin, it's just a different kind of environment. It's like very few people just have any hope for their life or for the future. And I was raised by some people that... Well, I was raised by my grandpa, and he wasn't an addict or an alcoholic, but I was also raised by my mom and my dad, and they had some issues with that. And for a while, I lived in an environment where that's just all that was going on. So the numbers are just incredible. I mean, let's say out of 10 people, I'd say maybe 7 of them use drugs intravenously. I mean, in the town, you know, that... Sure, those numbers are off, but I'm just talking about the people that I knew. You've always got your different classes of people, but just everywhere you went, there was somebody that was strung out. If the people that lived to the left of you weren't junkies, then the people that live on the right side of you definitely were. And that's just, I mean, that's, I don't know why, but that's just how it was growing up. There was no shame in it because it was acceptable. As far as everything else, I love Austin. That's my hometown. I love it. I love going there. I love seeing everybody, you know, that I grew up with. And, you know, that's me. I love it there. But I can't go back there because it is just infested with drugs. And I don't want to, not that, I mean, and I still go there. I go there and visit all the time. But I just don't. I don't have any plans of moving back there, you know. It was a nice place to grow up if I would have been influenced in the right way, I guess.
This is Jesse McIntosh. He's 24, and after close to a decade of addiction and multiple convictions, is just now starting to get his life on track.
I think I was like 11 or 12 when I moved to Austin. Pretty quickly, I think I was 13 when I smoked my first joint and drank for the first time. It didn't take off like a rocket at that point, but I definitely liked it, probably a little too much, and it definitely continued. By the time I was 15, I was selling drugs. It was just being around my family and things like that, things came my way that probably shouldn't have. So by the age of 15, I was selling pot, and I think by 15 I was starting to get into a little bit of worse drugs, like snorting pain pills like Lortabs and Percocets. Of course, when I started selling it, I started trading different drugs for different things, trying to make more money and all that stuff. I mean, that was just the lifestyle of everyone around me, and we're all born with this need to fit in, you know. Once I started doing prescription pills, you know, different pain pills, I mean, it just took off. You know, it's a very addictive. Basically, you know, what I started out with is a lot more mild than heroin, but what I ended up with is not. And it's very addictive, you know, physically. You know, you have to have it after a while, and it doesn't become fun anymore. It's just like a thing you do to feel okay. By the age of 19, I had basically tried about every drug but acid or LSD or opium or whatever, PCP. I don't know. I've never done any of that stuff, but meth, heroin, crack, coke. I started shooting up different pain pills, Oxycontin, Opanas, heroin, meth, and at that point in my life, by the way, I dropped out in 10th grade because I thought I could just be a successful drug lord. That's really what I wanted to be in life. I wanted to be a drug dealer. Okay, I guess a big part of my story is I was asleep waiting for my next fix on some pain medication. I was living with my grandma, by the way, and I had somebody in my bathroom that was cooking methamphetamine, which happened pretty regularly, wasn't anything new, but the cops busted in, and me and all the people that were in the house went to jail. One was my mildly mentally handicapped uncle that really didn't have anything to do with the meth, although he did it from time to time, but didn't have anything to do with the meth cooking at the time. And my girlfriend went to jail, and my dad went to jail as well. We all got the same charges, which was an A felony, manufacturing methamphetamine. We did 7 months in jail, and we all pled out to a D felony, and we got put on a lot of probation. So when I got released from jail, I went straight back out and started doing the same stuff with the pills. And I got so fed up with everything. I hadn't been going to probation. I'm sure my probation officer was about to put a warrant out for me. I decided I wanted to call my probation officer and tell her that I needed help because I didn't know what to do. And I did. And she said, all right, well, call me tomorrow and we're going to try to see what we can do to help you. That very same day, I went to my grandma's house to try to find a way to get well. And the cops busted in. Busted everybody. There was 14 people at my house. Everybody went to jail. My grandma got charged with dealing drugs, and I got revoked my probation and caught another maintaining common nuisance charge. That time going to jail, I did 90 days in jail, and I got offered an opportunity to go to the Salvation Army Adult Rehabilitation Center in Indianapolis, and I didn't really have any intentions on staying sober, really, in the back of my mind, but I thought, hey, if it's a way to get out, I'm open and I'm willing to do it. Now, I believe in God. I've been saved. I go to church. And it's like, I just feel obligated to something. Like, why did you not give it to me? Why did I get spared? Why me, you know?
Here is a second truth about me. I am an atheist. I was raised secular. I'd never even heard the word God until I was 7 or 8. Sometimes I wish I believed in God, a God, any higher power. But wishing isn't enough. I am impressed with people's belief. I'm humbled by it. But I'm also dubious of religion as an institution. It's difficult because these things are often seen as mutually inclusive.
Austin is very, very different. Everyone that has ever came to Austin has never expected it to be as bad as it is. The best way to describe it is a lot of the houses around here have not been taken care of, and everything is really cheap because almost every house around here is rented by the same renters. That has caused like a bunch of addicts to move into this area. Because of the, you know, how government housing, everything, nearly almost every apartment building is government housed. So it brings in a lot of people that would not necessarily move here for work or to start a family.
This is Holly Reynolds, who just 2 years ago, at 18, was the first person in town to actually do something about the epidemic.
To start off with, I'll tell you what Stand Up is. Stand Up was created for high school students to get more involved in the younger children in the community in order to, you know, be a role model for younger kids to not follow in their parents' decisions and find healthier ways to benefit their lives, but also help the high school students realize that they can make a difference if they wanted to. It was set up on Wednesdays for an hour to an hour and a half, and they got free meals, so we knew they got to eat that night, and if they needed food to bring home, we provided it because we got funded. We would provide the transportation. How it got started was there was an HIV epidemic in the town, and everyone was solely doing their interviews on the negatives in the community, and I thought that we could think of a more appropriate way to get attention than all negative. So I try to find a positive way. So I talk to kids within my school to see what they thought could change, and that's what we all came up with.
And how old were you when you started this?
I started this at the age of 18.
I think back to when I was that age, and I, you know, it's tough being a teenager, just in general, anywhere you are. And I can't imagine looking outside the scope of being a teenager sucks, I hate it, I don't know who I am. and, you know, taking a moment to not focus on yourself and maybe focus on the bigger things going on around you. So I commend you for that. But I also, what do you think it was that made you take a step back from all the trivial things that teenagers focus on and see the bigger issue around you?
Because you think about your future and how you want your children to be raised. And by helping the younger kids in this community, hopefully that generation won't be like the generation before me and choose to do negative things so that my kids, if I do decide to start a family in Austin, will have a better life here and it'll be a safe place for them to grow up. That's how I looked at it. I know that may sound a little bit selfish, but it's like, if I feel like we could move past this epidemic, then it would give this town a little more hope and a little less, you know, bad.
So when you came up with this idea, you know, and it's really easy to come up with ideas. I think execution is really what prevents a lot of great ideas from happening. How did you go about starting it, and what was the reception like when you began bringing it up to people?
At that moment, whenever the epidemic came, and I wrote a story called Her Story, and like it was hitting a lot of big newspapers. Like it was traveling around. I was visiting the state house. I was really, really involved in, like, had a lot of the spotlight, and I realized I could use that for my benefit when it came to like getting funded and like getting help. So that's how like it really got involved. Like, that's how we could get it started. So by having the connections I had at that moment, I was like, I have to take advantage of this because it's not going to stay here forever, because you know how news is, it comes and it goes. So that's how we really got it started.
So What's it like at 18, seeing this happen around you, taking a pretty aggressive approach to starting a conversation about it, and then having these really personal, engaging conversations with people who are addicts and who are HIV positive?
The most important thing, like, I would describe to the people that were affected by, you know, HIV or AIDS, was your voice is the only way people are ever going to understand. They're never going to fully, they're going to always criticize you or judge you. You get what I'm saying? And they're not going to understand it unless you put it into your voice. And I wanted them to feel like they had a say, because everyone was looking so poorly on them. And it was like, they're not bad people. They just made a bad decision.
Did this epidemic change the way you perceive drug addiction?
I've had family members and, you know, friends always do drugs. I don't feel like I'm necessarily a judgmental person. I feel like everyone has like their own problems and how they deal with them. So honestly, it didn't really faze me anyway at all.
I've listened to a lot of interviews from locals in town who don't have a lot of empathy for what these people are experiencing right now. What do you say to those people to try to help them understand what you're doing and why it's important to take care of them?
I totally get why people do not agree with, like, they made their own decisions of doing drugs. But if you think about it, in like a town of Austin where there is absolutely nothing to do, there's literally no nothing. There's no food. There's no entertainment. There's not a movie theater. There's little activity at the school unless you're into sports. Your parents do not work. So basically, you don't have a TV, you don't have a cell phone, you don't have anything else to do. And I feel like a lot of these issues are because it's what you're grown up around. You see everyone else in the town doing it. So chances are everyone that I've interviewed, they started doing drugs at 12, 13. So they never, I feel like you're a totally different person than when you're 12 than when you're 20 or 30. when you're a kid, you're immature and you think, okay, well, I can do this. My mom does it. My dad does it. So it's okay. And then they're addicted by the time they're 20.
I think that brings up a really good question, which is, what was it like working with these kids whose parents are addicts or family are addicts? And what do you think their perceptions and their realities around this drug and HIV epidemic were?
It was normal. Most kids that you talk to from Austin, probably ranging from the age of 7, know what a needle is, know what sexual intercourse is, and other things at 7 you should not even know about. And working with kids like that, you're just like, because I grew up in a town, I grew up in Madison, which is about 40 minutes away from Austin until I was in 8th grade, which really threw me off whenever I came to Austin and kids were talking about the things they were talking about, and it was a normal thing to them. That it's not weird here to be 7 years old and doing drugs or smoking or something.
How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel like, you know, at first it kind of makes you feel like an outcast. And then you're like, no, that's not weird that I feel a different way than kids around here. Nobody is coming to Austin to try to change the lives and make things different here. There's still the same abandoned houses. There's still nothing going on here that's changing the way lives are going to change here.
That, I think, is a tough and good question, which is, does it make you proud or angry that it took an 18-year-old girl to kind of stand up and start action and dialogue around this?
It makes me more angry than probably proud, because it shouldn't take an 18-year-old to write a story that anybody could have got, but they are too terrified to go talk to the people that actually had the HIV. Instead, they make assumptions about people, and that kind of makes me angry. Like, it's not like Austin is known to be a town full of violence or anything else, but instead of getting the real stories or the real truth of what goes on here, they take perceptions from people who do not have never knew what a drug was, or even sometimes not even ask a local about what's going on. They make their own, you know, decisions on that.
Here is a third truth. In 2006, I was sexually assaulted, and I contracted HIV from that assault.
We sang it late, sang it long.
HIV is something that changes you.
We lit our flame,
changes the way you see yourself, the way you see the world. Changes the way the world sees you, the way the world treats you. People make presumptions, as though those presumptions might justify whatever reaction they may have to you. So whatever they presume you've done might merit the outcome. It makes it easier for them to move on, to live their lives, to forget, to feel safe. HIV changes everything. At least at first. For a while. For now.
Different colors, one race. You could see the gaze, the face of hope beyond. One more fighting song. Sang it late, sang it long. Battered and beaten, we fought on. It took so long, is one. Just one beat.